Welcome to iConnect 007's roundtable discussion on utilizing process ionic residue testing as a process control tool. Our roundtable participants include Teresa Rowe, Senior Director of Assembly and Standards Technology at IPC, Graham Nesbitt, Chairman and CEO of Gen 3, Jason Keeping, Corporate Process Development at Celestica, and Doug Pauls, Principal Materials and Process Engineer at Collins Aerospace. Teresa, perhaps you can just start with a quick overview of some of the standard work around this from the IPC's point of view, please.
Certainly. A few years ago, we were in revision for JSTANDARD 001, and we received a comment concerning cleanliness and the cleaning section within the board and within the standard. And we readily realized as a group that there was no way to make a quick decision about this. So an action item was assigned, and Doug Pauls was voluntold, as he says, that he was going to lead the effort. And so it took them a few years, and they came back periodically with presentations to the group to explain where they were. And changes were introduced as an amendment to Revision G. And that was about a year and a half or so ago now. And that will be rolled into Revision H when it comes out by the end of the year.
Now, Graham, from Gen 3, you obviously have had a big role in this. Why don't you give us a brief introduction into the new standard, please? What it is and what it's not, if you will.
Well, the requirement that was put forward by Robert Bosch was to establish a pass-fail criteria that they could meet in delivering finished product to their customer base. And in order to do that, they had already identified the only requirement was to meet this particular, I hate using the word as Doug knows only too well, cleanliness number. And I have for 20 plus years campaigned to try to remove that, because the original concept of ROSE testing, as it has become commonly known, is to produce a standard of control to your manufacturing process in the context of the amount of ionic residue that might be found remaining on the surface of the assembly, and that might then cause problems long-term reliability from an electrochemical standpoint. And what we did was to provide them with five instruments in four different countries with three operators on every machine. And we carried out an exhaustive gauge R&R test, the culmination of which was to actually produce an instrument that would meet not just those particular process control parameters, but actually achieved and attained six verification, improvement in the process being a primary directive. What we did then was to take that to both IPC and IEC with a view to trying to get harmonization between documentation, because in my humble opinion, and I'm sure that both Jason and Doug, much less Teresa, would agree, IPC have much more leverage in the marketplace than do IEC, unless you live in Asia. To that extent, what happened was that events ran forward in so much as the document procedure in IEC somehow overran the document procedure that was going on with IPC. And Doug and myself are deeply involved in that as committee chairs, and we've been trying to get this moved forward pretty quickly. The problem, I suppose, is that historically, because of the way in which this particular test has been employed, people have regrettably come to refer to it as a cleanliness test. And that's the point that I have such heartache over, because it isn't a cleanliness test. It was never intended to be a cleanliness test. It was actually a way to improve the evaluation of surface ionics rather than using ion chromatography, which is a very long drawn out procedure and requires skilled operators. Let us produce a simplified ion chromatograph, which is what the Rose tester is. Because Rose has become so absolutely built into everybody's psyche, I thought doing a revision of Rose is just not going to work as simply as everybody might like. So rather than that, because there's nothing wrong with Rose test, and PICT is actually pretty much exactly the same thing, I gave it a different name because I don't think I'll live long enough to see the removal of that particular expression or acronym. Now, process ionic contamination testing, it means exactly what it says on the label. It needs to be sensitive enough to be able to detect changes that are occurring in your assembly manufacturing process by change of process materials, whether it's soldering products, solder flux, wire paste, whether it's underfills, adhesives, conformal coatings, your cleaning technique. All of these elements are an integral part of the overall production process. And all we want to do is to have a method that is sensitive enough to pick it up. We were selected because we were the only manufacturing supplier capable of not only meeting their particular requirements at Robert Bosch, but also to meet their Six Sigma requirements.
Let me ask you a question here, Graham. Mm-hmm. You're saying the Rose and the PICT are essentially similar. What's the primary difference? Is it speed?
It is sensitivity in the actual manufacturing or the instrument procedure. It is that the efficacy of it, as the Rose test stands today, it is differentiation between what is referred to in that particular document as the static versus dynamic. That is a very confusing picture that is presented to a potential customer, because if you talk to any engineer and say, would you like to buy a static tester or a dynamic tester, the instant reaction is on a dynamic tester. It's human nature. If you, however, point out that dynamic testing is open loop, whereas static testing is closed loop, that decision changes completely. We want closed loop. And one of the failures of this particular test, and keep in mind, all of the instruments on the market today take their heritage from the 1970s. And I believe Doug and certainly others were involved in much of the research that was being conducted in those days, because the US military, quite understandably, wanted to put a stake in the ground. Sure. And we need a number.
Sure. Let's pull Doug into this conversation. Doug, from your point of view, what was your role in this new standard?
Well, as Teresa indicated, I was voluntold. I actually kind of brought it on myself. At the time that this all took place in the 2015 timeframe, I was the general chairman of the cleaning and coating committees for IPC. That position is now held by Jason Keeping, also part of the panel today. And the story that that Graham had told, there are many parallel ones that we could all bring up that talked about people had relied on the Rose test as a tool for determining or differentiating acceptably clean from unacceptably dirty, acceptable from rejectable. The major flaw, and I will say that the Rose test is probably the most abused test in the industry, the overall assumption from most people was that if I met this spec, then I was acceptably clean. And there was a mounting degree of evidence in the industry that said this was no longer the case. As Graham had indicated, my first job in the industry as a young engineer was working with Bob Danoon and Bill Hobson, the originators of the Rose test at the Naval Avionics Center in Indianapolis. And they were always horrified at what the industry did with their test. It was intended to be a process control test, but the military took it and made it a product acceptance test. And so most of us who deal with the issues of ionic residues and their impact on overall reliability knew this to be a case. We knew that this test was broken, that the pass-fail criterias established in the late 1970s and early 1980s really was done for a different material set, and so really wasn't valid anymore. But in any case, you know, in the IPC committees, they keep using it until something better is put in its place. And I think Dan Foster, who at the time, along with Teresa, who led the J Standard 1 committee, got tired of me bellyaching about it and turned to me in one of the meetings and said, "Doug, you're right." Said, "We all understand that this test is broken, needs to be fixed." Said, "Yes, it does." Then he said, "Well, don't we have an IPC committee that deals with the cleanliness of electronic assemblies?" And I say, "Yes, we do." That, "Aren't you the general chairman of the cleaning and coding committees?" "Yes, I am." And I could feel the noose tightening, but there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it. So he said, "Would you not be then, you know, with a lifetime of experience in this and chairman of the committees, be the appropriate one to lead this A team?" I guess. So that was in 2015. And so we got together about, I would say maybe 15 people who dealt with the issue of, or who had been dedicated to answering the two questions in the industry. How clean is clean? How do you measure cleanliness? And how clean is clean enough? How do you determine what is and is not acceptably clean? And so we did a lot of work. We had a lot of discussions. We met probably two or three times a month for probably 2.5-3 years. And it culminated in J Standard 1, Rev G Amendment 1. Now, what a lot of people had come to me during this time and said, "Well, if we can't use the old number, if this 1.56 value, if we can't use this anymore, what do we use? What number do we use?" He said, "It's not that easy. This is a very complex thing. There is no one-size-fits-all cleanliness standard. There are some electronics, by virtue of their density or their function, that may tolerate a lot of material, a lot of ionic material. There are others whose function is more critical, maybe they're much more dense, that cannot take these high levels of residues. Every assembly has their own cleanliness threshold.
Doug, is this a specification that the buyer of the board is then responsible for submitting to the fabricator?
Well, that's a good question. One of the questions that we frequently get in to with the RevG Amendment 1, which is presently in force, whose responsibility is it to generate the data? And what I have told people and what we're working on clarifying as well is that the manufacturer is. And I have a couple of examples that may clarify whose responsibility it is to determine what the right number or numbers should be. Collins Aerospace manufactures very high reliability aviation electronics. And let us say that I choose to use a very high quality contract manufacturer, Celestica, for example, since I know Jason's on the call. Now, most of the contract manufacturers are going to have their preferred sources of material, and they would generate their objective evidence that they meet the current protocols. As part of that development, they may or they will probably have done some determination of what should their new rows number be for process control, not product acceptance, but process control. If I choose to have a Collins Aerospace product manufactured by Celestica, I could simply accept their objective evidence and say, here, build my product with your material set. So Jason provides the objective evidence, and I buy off on that, and we use that. If, on the other hand, I look at that and go, well, I'm not really comfortable with your material sets, I would like you to use my material sets on my product, which, of course, many of the contract manufacturers will do. At that point, in my opinion, generating the objective evidence becomes a shared responsibility. It's shared from the standpoint that I am requiring someone to use my materials. And so in order to give me a measure of assurance that my product works, we would jointly generate the data between our two companies, share the cost. Celestica learns about a new material database. Perhaps maybe it's an improvement over what they're doing. I get, as an OEM, I get the data that says I have confidence that my equipment is now clean enough and it meets my criteria. So that's kind of an overall view of whose responsibility is it.
So Jason, let's pull you in on this conversation. So when you're working with an OEM like Collins Aerospace, what's that process like for you in terms of the testing and documentation?
So I think actually working with an OEM that understands the principles of what's going on is much easier. I mean, when I worked with Doug, you know, with Collins Aerospace, they already knew why things were changing. So we kind of understand a little bit of the history, late 70s, early 80s, you know, when the controls were put in place, what were they from? At that time, we were all using tin lead solder paste alloys. We were using water wash alloys. We were using only pin through hole components, maybe the odd QFP. A lot of that design products and where we are today has greatly changed. And that's why when Graham's points earlier about the old value just being a blind acceptance test and what Doug was looking at doing, how do you have what's acceptable now? So as things transitioned into lead free, you started getting different densities, different components, different packages. When OEMs like Doug's knew that these changes had occurred, they would be able to work with to provide, okay, this is a gauntlet of testing we need to do, find out what the chemistries look like, what does the cleaning process produce and put out, and then now that we have a common number, is that common number acceptable? Usually there is, yes, it is. Okay, we'll use that as a process control. We'll go forward. If there was not, then we'd work out together, why was it not? Was it a process control? Was it a materials control? You know, what was the difference that didn't get us to where we needed to? But having individuals that were knowledgeable on it is a lot more easier to work with, because then you can have those discussions. But if they don't know the background of why we changed from a solid set number into now getting objective evidence, that discussion was usually more difficult.
Well, part of this whole process of testing is really for you to understand your processes through testing, Seer, and how often are you actually testing your process with the test coupons?
So usually what happens is at the beginning of a program, you have to understand material compatibility. So based on those alloys, based on the materials, what does that all look like? Is it compatible? So that's a baseline test that needs to be done, you know, for compliance. Once that's been done, then you have to have a frequency put in place. Oh, how often now do we validate that the process is still in control? And so that's kind of where then the PIC test and other test tools come in, where now they are used continuously in manufacturing to validate that that process control that's been established by technical objective data is still being met.
And the PIC test, one of the advantages, speed in this circumstance, yes?
Correct, yes.
A question that I get frequently is that, well, if we can't use our ionic cleanliness testers anymore, you know, do we just get rid of them? And my answer is no. They're still a perfectly valid process control tool. They're quick. I would say that most of the, I will say, more modern ionic testers that exist are repeatable and are reproducible. There have been great improvements of that since they were introduced in the 80s and 90s. There are still a lot of very old ones out there, but the modern ones are repeatable and reproducible. The fact that almost all of us, from various contracts over the years, have one of these instruments in place means that at least let's use the tool that we have, but let's use it properly. Let's understand what the numbers mean. And, you know, a lot of what we're going to go through now, if you're an old fart like Graham and I, and you lived through the changes in the industry that came about when we went from chlorofluorocarbon cleaning and high solids RMA fluxes. If you were around in the early 90s when the Montreal Protocol went into effect, very few people really understood their fluxes or really understood cleaning. But with the moves to low solids or no clean fluxes, water soluble fluxes, synthetic fluxes, if you talked about aqueous cleaning, solvent cleaning, semi-aqueous cleaning, supercritical CO2 cleaning, now everyone was forced to really understand their materials and what kind of residues do we get, how do they impact my long-term performance or reliability. And we're going to be going through the same thing now all over again. So
I interviewed a gentleman, Tom Forsythe, some time ago, talking about the cleaning process. And he made a point that I hadn't really considered, but I want to bring it up here, is that with the no clean applications that we've had for many years, that we basically have a generation of engineers that don't really understand the cleaning process, is how he kind of put it. And you know, you're talking about having people that are knowledgeable. What would you say to that? Jason, let's start with you on that.
So I think as we started looking at the test methods, a lot of the way the testing was done, it was extracting a certain amount of ionics from the residues that was in the wash materials to find out was it still good. A lot of the solder paste and solder alloy manufacturers started to think, how can we do the alloys, but then not have those ionics, yet there was still residue on the cart? And so that was where what Graham had said earlier about just having this blind number, you could still have visible residue on a card, but you would get this number and it would say, oh, look, I'm clean, but yet you can still physically see the residue. And that's where if you're not understanding what the cleaning is or what it actually does, you wouldn't know that, oh, I should actually take a look at this deeper because it's something's not right. Something's not working correctly. And that's where I think the comment that Tom probably said was people that don't know that, don't know to peel that onion, that second level down to take a look at it, they wouldn't be aware of that issue. And for me, when I started looking at conformal coatings later, those residues do cause reliability issues for the conformal coating. And it's a very easy way to check. But when you've got product which is not conformal coated, and those residues are then shipped out in that format, it does become a big issue.
Right.
May I interject?
Yes, please, Graham.
Part of the problem is that when the Montreal Protocol was put into effect, there was a huge amount of research done. And one of the major culminating factors from it was, as Jason just mentioned, no clean fluxes. Dr. Wally Rubin of Multicore Solders, way back in the day, was the original inventor of no clean fluxes. And one of the problems that was faced by the group evaluating non-CFC cleaning was, well, if we've got no clean, how do we test for it? And that led to an interesting dialogue that spread over about 5 years, where we tried to figure out, well, if that can't tell us, why can't it tell us? Number one, many of the additives, and today all of the additives, are largely non-ionic surfactants used to help with either wetting or de-wetting, as the case may be. But they are contributors to failure on an electrochemical standpoint. What we therefore decided in the British Collaborative CFC Elimination Program, which was headed up by Dr. Colin Lee of then the NPL, and for whom an OBE was awarded, and just for everybody listening in, the definition of an OBE is other buggers' efforts. Sorry for the language, but it's a truism. Nonetheless, it's a distinction for Colin in the work that he did. And the only technique that was determined suitable for this program was to measure changes to insulation resistance, because it cares not whether it is an organic or an inorganic. It doesn't care whether it is ionic, non-ionic. It only looks for electrochemical reliability. Ergo, if you find that you have a problem, that's when you need to go look and determine what is there that's causing the problem. And for that, you are now into an awful lot more in-depth research that can extend into paying test laboratories fortunes to deal with either ion chromatography, worst case FTIR, worst case Raman spectroscopy, and who knows what else. So what happened was that the initiation of an insulation resistance test would be a useful way to try to ascertain whether or not your product, from an electrochemical standpoint, is going to be reliable in service. That is the first stage that is now a requirement for manufacturers in order to determine what would then be a suitable process ionic contamination test. Why that as well as? Because SIR testing, regrettably, is not a short duration exercise. Worst condition is that it actually relies upon a specifically dedicated test assembly that is a replication of what is intended for the end product. But once you've established good SIR conditions, these are all written up in the IPC standards, we then have the ability to control that by having a very sensitive instrument that can carry out this check in as little as 3 minutes to give the producer. And as Jason is there representing Celestica as well as IPC, having somebody that can give you a go, no-go answer in 3 minutes is one hell of a lot better than having somebody tell you, well, the test's got another 4 days to run. Right. As an extension to that, and this is an important and very key point because it's bang up to date, evidence is now bouncing around the industry on a global basis that we now have some problems where no clean fluxes, and who knows about other forms of flux, because most people are buying no clean fluxes, but they're cleanable. And the issue is that there is a trigger point at approximately 500 hours into test where failures are ramping up. And the longer the duration of the test, the more concerned people are going to be. Because never lose sight of the fact that when we were writing up all of these standards back in the 70s, the test coupon that everybody around the world recognizes instantly is the B24. The separation between the conductive paths on that coupon is 500 micron, half a millimeter. Well, most people don't manufacture electronics like that anymore. Certainly not automotive, certainly not medical, certainly not if you talk to the likes of Apple, LG, Samsung, and anybody else. They're significantly finer tracks. And therefore, the susceptibility for failure, does it matter? If my phone fails in a year, the manufacturer of the phone, you're out of warranty. If that happens on your car, or it happens on your aeroplane, that means one hell of a lot. People are going to die. So all of these elements in the equation are becoming more and more of concern, and that's why PICT is so important. But keep this in mind. This is the first of four new documents, test standards, that are coming out. I'm trying to make sure, as far as I possibly can, as the new vice chair of the Cleaning and Coating Committee, under the guidance of Jason, from the historical background that Doug has, to ensure that the new documents that we produce out of IPC are as bang up to date as we can possibly make them. Now, here is the dilemma. Automotive, because of electric vehicles, not such a big issue in America, unless you're working for Tesla, maybe Chrysler, maybe GM. But in Europe and the Far East, in particular China and India, this is huge. And the requirement is ultra high voltage. And we're having to deliver instruments for measuring insulation resistance at levels of greater than 1500 volts for a test duration of greater than 2000 hours. At every committee meeting in IPC for the last 3 years, I have raised this subject, and the reaction around the room is, oh my God, I'm not going to do that. the safety implications are incredible. And of course, my insurance to sell into America is 10 times greater than anywhere else. So this is a far bigger topic than picked on its own, as Doug has already mentioned. And the big concern for everybody is, okay, automotive, high voltage, high reliability, safety critical. Okay, aerospace and defense, lower voltage, mostly. Safety critical, yes. You don't want to have the guy that fired the missile asks if anybody saw where it went. And then in the bottom end of the scale, but equally important, especially in view of what's going on around the world now, medical electronics and space electronics, they want ultra low voltage, and they're working down to a spacing between conductors on their circuitry of 50 microns. I have customers that are actually asking for us to produce circuits that are at 6 micron separation. We're damn near at semiconductor level. So we've got big challenges, and I speak for all three of us working with IPC. We've got a heck of a lot of work to do, and never forget, every bit of information and documentation produced is produced on a volunteer basis.
Right.
Yeah, we've all got a vested interest.
Right. Now, you've mentioned one of four, so we have three more to go. Teresa, when you look at a project like this where we have four more or three more to go, what impact or what concerns would you have?
So as Graham mentioned, all of our work comes from industry through volunteers, and we can't be more appreciative of those volunteers. They are really developing the documentation for the industry, and we're a conduit for that. And it's difficult sometimes to have multiple projects going at the same time. All three of these guys will tell you that, you know, time is precious, and we find that as we get stretched thinner, we don't have the time to commit to more projects. But we take them based on priority. And sometimes we do see a number of projects being worked at the same time, and they might go along a little more slowly than we had anticipated. But ultimately, at the end of the day, it comes down to what does the industry need? And so I see these moving forward and developing at a rate that Jason and Doug and Graham will be able to pace it. We depend on them to pace it based on what they have as input and what they need. And we try to get those resources from them or for them as they need them. We've talked a little bit about any kind of round robin testing funding that's needed to do things. Sometimes they'll produce a white paper because a white paper is ultimately faster. It doesn't need the larger committee sometimes to have the input. And so there are different ways that they can get their messages out there. And we look to them to help us give that guidance.
There's a shift in paradigm from the ROSE test and how it's been used to process control. But Doug, you've dealt with a lot of EMS. I would think process control was being measured in any case, yes? Or is this some new thinking that's going on?
Well, I would have to say that I look at a lot of this as like development of a toolbox. A lot of the things that we're doing for IPC is to develop new tools for determining is the residue level that we have acceptable, unacceptable, under one conditions, are they acceptable or unacceptable? From the standpoint of process control, our industry has relied on the ROSE for decades to be our lone process control tool for determining, can I ship product? And it's going to take quite a bit of education to get away from that. Now, there have been tools that have been used quite effectively. Ion chromatography is part of it. SIR is part of it. There are many different ways in which you can control a manufacturing process. But unfortunately, the only tool that really everyone knows, everyone has used, has been the Rose test. Now, in the past, I would say 20 years, prior to my coming to Collins Aerospace 20 years ago, I was technical director of Contamination Studies Laboratories, which is now Foresight. And so as a company back then and to this day, many of them use ion chromatography to determine, you know, where are possibly our hot spots in the manufacturing process. Properly understood, this is a new tool. The problem being is that, as Graham indicated earlier, ion chromatography is not a quick test. It takes an hour-long extraction, and then it takes rather sophisticated equipment. You're looking at probably a $75,000 to $100,000 investment, and then you need someone who can set up the methods and set up the interpretation. So it's not cheap. Now, I have both IC and SIR. I use it daily. Both of them, I think, are worth their weight in gold. I use them as tools all the time, but they're not common. And so I think a lot of what our committee is doing is trying to educate people on how do we look at process control with a more modern view. How do we determine if we can't use the 1.56 value, what should we be using, and how do we use it as a process control tool? Now, Teresa earlier had mentioned white papers, and our particular A team that developed what became REVG's Amendment 1, we developed an explanatory white paper, WP-19A, that was to go along with it, that would educate the people on what exactly this new cleaning protocol, what this new wrench did. And it's had very good reviews so far. And as J Standard 1 goes into revision H, which I expect would be finished at some point later this year, that white paper is or will be revised in order to answer a lot of the questions that have come up. Did I answer your question, Barry, or did I just dance around it?
I think you did.
Okay.
Coming over to Jason, kind of to follow that thought, with the new testing paradigm, Jason, have you improved process performance and capability? Or in other words, what are the benefits that you've seen so far?
Well, I think Doug and both Graham noted it, not more like I've seen more benefits for us, because a lot of the times our processes already were in control. It's more just a lot of education, right? A lot more information, and a lot of our even OEMs, I mean, Collins Aerospace are very knowledgeable on it, but a lot of others are not. And when we come back to them and we say, oh, this value is no longer a valid test point, we need to do some other process control, they're like, what do you mean? Like, they, even though they own their own products, this is still a transition right now, that this information is still needs to get to all the different OEMs as well. So for us,
it's really helping. I'm sorry. It's really helping position you as a thought leader and educating your customer base.
Correct. And so when we can go through showing our manufacturing process controls about the way we do handling, the way the equipment is put together, the gauge R&Rs to make sure everything is repeatable, it's always given the same process, showing all that data with the objective evidence with the customer on the new things of how to get a new process control point, then they understand what that means. Now, that's when they clean. When they don't clean, and then they try using this number, it's a much different discussion point, and it's a lot more complicated. So right now, this has been a guideline that cleanliness, as Graham kind of noted earlier, it's not really what it meant, that based on if I do this testing and my product is meets 1.56, then my product is cleanliness assessment that it's good. A lot of people have taken that to heart as stone as, oh, it doesn't matter what I do if I clean or I don't clean. If I reach that value, my board is acceptable ionically. Now, with the changes from tin lead and lead free to lead free, different densities from the pin through holes now to QFNs, that knowledge some OEMs are not aware of. And to get them to understand that and to show them the objective evidence why that number is no longer valid, it's much more complicated.
They would be motivated, though, I would think, Jason, by the number of failures 500 hours down the road.
Yes, but then it goes back to what is the market? Is it a product that only lasts 100 hours? True. Is it a product that lasts a couple weeks? But then you have to look at it. Sometimes they also look at it from a cost point of view. I add in a cleaning process is going to be an extra value of cost. But then you have to start looking at them when you talk to them. It's like, okay, but don't look at it at the cost point. Look at it from a total cost of ownership point of view. So you're going to add a little cost now, but over the long run and lifespan, you save all these failures, reliability warranties, and the overall total cost of ownership actually goes down.
Right. So
it's more of education from a whole point of view.
And you're not even getting into the litigious side of things where product liability comes back to them.
Correct.
So the cost could be, you know, astronomical for sure.
Exactly.
We're coming up on an hour, you guys. So this is really interesting. Why don't we just walk through and ask if there's anything that we haven't talked about that you really feel like we should include in this conversation? Teresa, why don't we start with you?
I think we've covered the majority of it. I would encourage the listeners who have additional questions to reach out to any one of us for further discussion, for further explanation. We recognized, as Doug mentioned, and I'll reiterate, we recognized even when this topic was introduced to the 001 task group at large, after the A team had worked on it for a while, we had a lot of skeptical people, we had some inquisitive people, we had some scrunched eyebrows, foreheads, and it really took even an education at that level to begin to have a conversation. And I'd be interested if any one of the three of them disagrees with me. But I think that over the course of the couple of years or 3 years that they worked on this, even the task group became more educated, the task group members became more educated on the finer points of this. And that's why they were adamant, and so was the A team, that this white paper that Doug talked about accompany the amendment, that it really had to be part of the education process so that the industry at large could put the information to use and put it to use properly. And I think that's a huge takeaway for this.
Great. Thank you, Teresa. Graham, do you have any thoughts?
No, I think that's all been covered in great detail. As everybody has pointed out, education is the key issue. We have a transient workforce in our industry. They come on board, they work with the company for 2-3 years, they learn something, they go on to another posting somewhere else. And increasingly, what we've got is that the industry especially in China. And I mention that very specifically because developmental work in the context of getting a reliable product happens at a pace in China that the West cannot hope to keep up with. They just have so many people thrown at it. It's quite scary. And something that's been discussed at great length in years gone by, IPC run a fantastic technical forum called the TechNet. And Doug, myself, I'm sure Jason as well, have been members of the TechNet pretty much from its inception. That goes back, believe it or not, Doug, over 20 years. Yep. And some of the conversations that have taken place are that, you know, this whole move toward lead-free doesn't make any sense. But the biggest problem for humanity is the world is full of an awful lot of people. And at some point, there's going to be an incident that brings everything back to some really scary realization effects. And sadly to report, we are now, all of us, living that nightmare because of this virus. I've just had conversations with our partners in India, and the Prime Minister of India is proposing to extend the lockdown to the 3rd of November. What's happening elsewhere in the world varies gigantically. But make no mistake, handling this, producing the electronic equipment and materials to actually deal with the massive boom in medical electronics that's happening requires some very fast thinking. And it needs an awful lot of very clever people to get a handle on this, to move this forward. We cannot rely on what we did 20, 30 years ago or more. It doesn't apply anymore.
Good point. Good point.
God save us all.
Doug, how about you? Any final thoughts?
Well, I guess I would build a little bit upon what Graham had indicated. It's kind of interesting. We look at what's going on with the pandemic, and my background in looking at the effects of residues, I am now on our company's disinfecting team. And, you know, we can't get all of the disinfectants we used to get because everyone's buying them. So which ones can we be used? There are very few people out there who can really determine the effects of these residues on electronics. I happen to be one of them. So, you know, Graham had talked about the value of education, and I wouldn't be able to be in the position that I'm in had it not been for the education that I've gotten from IPC throughout the years. And so there's a lot of work that's going on to better characterize materials, to better characterize the effects of residues on assembly performance. Graham had talked about TechNet, an excellent tool to be used. But I would say participation in the IPC's technical committees is an educational arena that cannot be matched anywhere. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of the work that went into J Standard 1, Rev G Amendment 1, which was done by this A team, or as we called it, the Rhino team, is now being formalized as an IPC committee. So, you know, the question that I get from people a lot is that, well, Doug, I need to come up this learning curve very rapidly for my company. How would I do that? And so part of that is becoming more educated, being involved with the IPC, The IPC has a lot of educational materials that is with it, but participation is really our best investment.
So let's move to you, Jason. Any final thoughts from your point of view?
So I would probably just re-elaborate what was said by Teresa earlier, in that a lot of the industry groups are volunteers, but then as Doug mentioned, we had the RINO team or subject matter expert group, and it's not that we were all very good at what we did, but by being all together, the synergies by listening to different experts of different technologies, we're able to learn how to put all that together for the industry for the best solution of what needed to happen. Now, you can always have a whole group of people that were all chemistry, but they don't know the equipment, they don't know the process, they don't know the incoming. So by having that group and team of different areas of expertise was phenomenal. That was why we were able to put together what we did. Going back to some of the stuff that Doug invited me into, and now by being part of, we actually started every 2 years having a conference on just assembly cleaning and conformal coating. Doug and I did a lot of the workshops at the beginning of the course, and between the group of us, including Graham, there's over, you know, I'd say over 50 for sure, close to 100 years of experience that's in that content. And when you start looking at how to educate people new, that are new to the subject, by being able to attend these events, you know, by just being there, the amount you can absorb by listening to other experts is phenomenal. So being just relevant and present, I think, is the best thing.
Well, you're bringing up a great point that you've connected a supply chain in developing this new standard. And those viewpoints really, you know, probably made that process so much better overall, the better end result.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well done.
Yeah, because I mean, because if you only looked at it from the cleaning agent point of view only, or an OEM point of view, or the equipment, or the manufacturer, you would get different levels of expertise and different requirements. Having everyone together, we figured out how did those aspects work, how did they interrelate, and what needed to happen to move all of it forward, which is what was done.
Right. Now, Doug, you're the OEM in the room here. What advice would you give to other OEMs regarding this new standard and the approach?
Well, OEMs as a group have a tendency to take the standpoint, you know, be reasonable, do it my way. And a lot of OEMs would say, I want you to use my material sets, but I want you to pay for it. And this really needs to be a shared responsibility. And I think that needs to be understood by everyone who's out there right now. This is not something you can't take all the burden and put it on your contract manufacturer. You can't even put it on your own manufacturing lines. There's a lot of new information that needs to be done. People need to be open to generating new data sets. I guess the one point that I would say, there is no one-size-fits-all cleanliness requirement anymore. That horse has left the barn. And so you have to determine what is acceptable or unacceptable for your product, and that is most often done collaboratively with whoever is doing the manufacturing.
Well, I would think, you know, just listening to you and Jason talk, that relationship of customer and supplier has to be incredibly strong because of the way you guys are interlocked in this process.
It works a lot better, I think, if the contract manufacturer and the OEM are willing to work together. I have seen cases where, in essence, it is an adversarial relationship, and it does not work there very well.
Well, thank you all for taking time out today to help educate the industry about this new process. It's certainly appreciated, and we certainly appreciate the years of dedication you put in generating this.
Glad to be of service.
Yep.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate it.